order of the Public Safety and Security Policy and Finance Committee and start out with the roll call.
Representative Cornish.
Here.
Representative Johnson.
Here.
Representative Hillstrom.
Here.
Representative Becker-Finn. Representative Considine. Representative Dean.
Here.
Representative Frankie. Representative Grossel.
Here.
Representative Howe.
Present.
Representative Lummer.
Here.
Representative Lucero.
Here.
Representative Neuberger.
Ready to serve.
Representative O'Neill.
Here.
Representative Pinto. Representative Ward. Representative Zerwas.
Okay, Representative O'Neill, would you like to move the minutes for February 7th?
So moved, Chair.
Okay, Representative O'Neill moves the minutes for February 7th. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, today we have the Minnesota Judicial Branch budget request in front of us. So whoever wants to begin, it's your name and title, and welcome.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Jeff Shorba. I'm the State Court Administrator for the Minnesota Judicial Branch. I'm here this morning to review the Minnesota Judicial Branch budget and present the Judicial Branch's fiscal year 18-19 biennial budget request. I'm joined by Judge Kevin Mark from the 1st Judicial District and President of the Minnesota District Judges Association, who's going to assist me when we get to the compensation portion of the request. I'd like to start with an explanation of the Judicial Branch budget. The Judicial Branch budget is appropriated by the legislature to the three levels of court. Our fiscal year 16-17 budget is shown on this slide. In total, funding for the third branch of Minnesota's government totals less than 2% of the general fund. Judicial Branch has also allocated funds for civil legal services programs. For fiscal year 16 and 17, that amount was a little over $26 million. It's a pass-through grant program. The Judicial Branch does not retain any of those funds, and I know you'll be hearing from Civil Legal Services about their request for fiscal year 18-19. District Court budget, the largest budget, is broken down into five categories that are listed on this slide, and I'll take a few minutes to walk through each of those categories for the District Court budget. The district budget funds the district court employees in each of our 106 court locations spread over 87 counties in Minnesota. The operations budget for the district court pays for expenses, supplies, travel, and around $743,000 in rent that is paid for our district offices where there's not room in our local courthouses. The judge budget, of course, pays the salaries and expenses of the 291 district court judges. So you can see on each of these slides as I'm going through them the breakdown in the percentages between personnel and operating expenses. The central budget provides funding for our nine judicial district administrators, some of our overhead accounts, so for example paying out workers' compensation, unemployment insurance, pays for our central self-represented litigant staff, and our centralized court payment staff. The treatment court budget, as I've talked about with this committee before, provides funding towards 27 of our 58 treatment courts. The remaining cost is provided by grants from the Office of Traffic Safety, Federal Bureau of Justice Assistance, Office of Justice Programs, and the Department of Human Services. The last of the funds is what we call mandated services. I'll talk about this even in more detail as we get into our requests, but the mandated services budget stems from requirements in the Minnesota Constitution, federal and state laws, and Minnesota court rules, which mandate that certain services be provided to individuals in the court system. The judicial branch is responsible for paying for those mandated services pursuant to Minnesota statutes. So this budget includes, for example, staff people, jury managers, staff psychologists and psychiatrists, interpreters, which account for about 22% of the budget. And then the operations portion of this budget is the largest, 78%. And that includes things like juror, mileage, and per diem, contract interpreters, contract psychiatrists and psychologists, and the cost of informal pauper expenses and standby counsel. You had also asked about federal funds, so I wanted to cover some of the federal funding that we have received in 16 and 17. There are three areas of federal funding in the trial court budget. The first is a little over $5 million that we received to fund treatment courts. These grants are primarily provided by the Department of Justice. The second is our expedited child support program. Federal government pays for 66% of the expenses for this program. So this would bear, we'd be trying to have child support magistrates process child support modification cases, and we budget and pay for the remaining 34%. And then we've received a few grants from the State Justice Institute, $72,000 in 16 and 17. Those were used to do some enhanced technology learning for our self-represented litigant program. We received some money to do a guardian and conservator program that I've talked about with the committee as well. And then we have received a new grant of $30,000 that will continue into the next biennium to develop a guardian reporting system similar to what we have done for our conservators. And those all came from the federal government, the State Justice Institute.
Representative Hilstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I could ask about the federal funding. So is all the federal grants received applied for through the local jurisdiction and then you administer them, or does the state council actually go out, judicial council go out and apply for any of these grants and receive the money and then make decisions about how to distribute the money to the local jurisdictions?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hilstrom, it depends on the grant. The State Justice Institute grants that you see here are all applied from the State Court Administrator's office. They have to be signed off by the Chief Justice and the State Court Administrator. The Expedited Child Support Program is just an ongoing program where the federal government is funding these child support procedures, so it's not like we have to apply for those every year. We do have to report how many cases we have, et cetera, to the federal government. And then for the treatment courts, the locals decide if they would like to apply for a drug court grant, and then it goes through the Judicial Council for approval. So it depends on the program.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Gilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So and maybe you're going to talk about this when you talk about the treatment courts, but isn't it true that if the local jurisdiction applies for funding for the treatment courts through the state and then they get a federal grant that they have to return the state money?
Mr. Sherba.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hilstrom. This last particular year, we knew of five courts who were applying for federal funding, and so when we were looking at an allocation of drug court funding, we didn't know if they were going for this last fiscal year. We didn't know if they were going to get the grants or not, so the funding was contingent on if they got the grant, then they'd obviously have federal money, and they didn't need the state money. So that was the circumstance that we had this last biennium.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hilstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And do you anticipate that that will be the policy and procedure going forward? Because we don't necessarily want to disincentivize local jurisdictions from applying for federal money to maximize on our state dollars.
Mr. Sherb.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hilstrom, we don't want to either. Usually what happens in these types of circumstances is that the drug court will get a lot more money from the federal than they would get in our state allocation. So it's really not a disincentive because if they get the grant, the funding is much higher than it would be in the state program.
One last question, Mr. Chair.
Follow up. Go ahead.
Does the state court charge the local jurisdiction any administration costs of any kind? We see, like, with some of the Office of Justice Programming programs that they take a portion of that grant funding for the administrative costs. Does the Judicial Council or some entity take any portion of that federal grant money for administration?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hilstrom, we do not. If the federal grant comes through, all that goes to the local jurisdiction.
Thank you.
You proceed.
So I will move on to the Court of Appeals, which is a much more streamlined budget. It funds staff, Court of Appeals judges, and operational costs. So as you can see here, personnel accounts for 88% of the Court of Appeals budget. There are 70 employees there, to include law clerks, administrative assistants, some central attorney staff. And then the operation expenses account for the other 12% of the budget. I will just note a little over half of those operating costs are rent. We pay rent to the Department of Administration for the Minnesota Judicial Center, and that's allocated to each of the offices within the Judicial Center, and so a little over $1.4 million of those operational costs are rent. The Supreme Court budget, there are a number of different categories within the Supreme Court budget, which I'll talk through in a little bit more detail. The two I just want to mention that I was not going to go into great detail, one is the courthouse security grant program, where the legislature allocated $1 million to give grants to local jurisdictions for courthouse security improvements. That grant opportunity is now posted, and we're accepting applications until the beginning of March for that $1 million. And then the community dispute resolution grants. This is a program established under Minnesota statute. Grants are provided to nonprofits to mediate cases, and again, this is just a pass-through from the Supreme Court for this cost.
Mr. Shorman?
Yes. Mr. Chair?
Have you seen any of the grant applications for courthouse security? And then are you going to put a limit per grant so that somebody doesn't apply and take three-fourths of it up all of a sudden? Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, they have started coming in. We haven't had a lot of them yet. It was just posted at the beginning of the year. The committee that the Chief Justice has formed to advise her on the grant program has talked about the limit. I think what we'll do is we'll probably follow the same approach that we took with our other grant program that you authorized, where we're going to try to give as many out as possible. So we're certainly not going to give some entity $900,000 and then not have any money left. So that'll be taken into consideration, I'm sure, by the committee.
And so far, what have you heard or seen what the grant usually asks for, their number one priority, like glass or screening or personnel or certain type of doors? What have you seen so far?
Mr. Chair, in our discussions with the counties about this, as we've been sort of going out, it's sort of been a myriad of requests. Some have been for things like bulletproof glass, as you mentioned, or trying to secure some doors or more cameras or something like that. Others may want to try to implement some kind of a weapon screening, so they might be asking for some personnel costs. Of course, we need to make clear with them that this is only one-time money, so ongoing costs would be the responsibility of the local jurisdictions. But we've heard that there are probably going to be a lot of applications, probably more than we can fund with $1 million. But that's just a hunch from what we've been hearing.
In your experience statewide, if they have a ban on weapons in the courtroom and screening, will there be at least one uniformed personnel in these courts with a firearm?
Mr. Chair, my experience has been that if you're going to use weapon screening, you would need to have at least one person who has a weapon. Otherwise, it's sort of futile to do it any other way. And that's the advice, if we were ever to do it in the Minnesota Judicial Center, that's the advice that Capitol Security and the Public Safety Department has given to us as well, that okay. You'd have at least one person there with the firearm.
All right, thank you. Go ahead, proceed.
So the Supreme Court budget, I'll talk a little bit in detail about these. Supreme Court operations, 80% of the Supreme Court operational budget is spent on composition for staff and justices. Again, staff would include law clerks, administrative assistants, clerk of appellate court's office. Over half of this operations budget for the Supreme Court is again spent on rent. So the rent for the Supreme Court offices is about $1.326 million. My office is responsible for the business side of the courts, providing infrastructure services to all three levels of courts in the areas of technology, education, finance, human resources, and coordination of statewide programs and best practices. 80% of my budget funds the central infrastructure to support technology, human resources, and finance functions for all levels of our court. And you can see the seven divisions in my office that operate to provide those kinds of services. The State Law Library, this budget pays for the State Law Librarian and 12 staff, which accounts for about 43% of the budget. The operations budget pays for, obviously, books, periodicals, supplies, and again, a little over $1 million in rent for the State Law Library. In 2015, the law library staff responded to an estimated 7,000 information requests and a little over 4,000 visitors who used the library's resources. The expedited child support program that I mentioned was created to address federal mandates to provide the resolution of child support matters in a streamlined, uniform, and accessible fashion. Our budget includes 22 child support magistrates who live and serve in each of our district courts. Proceedings are presided over by a child support magistrate appointed by the chief judge in each district. And in 2016, 24,000 cases were processed in the expedited process. Federal funds, we receive two grants through the Supreme Court and the State Court Administrator's Office. The first grant is the Department of Justice Domestic and Sexual Violence Grant. It's funded by the U.S. Department of Justice's Office on Violence Against Women. Each state receives funds to develop and strengthen criminal justice's response to domestic violence. And as part of the federal government's grant, 5% of that grant must be provided to the courts. And we use that grant to provide training, maintaining information that we provide to the federal government, doing forms and orders to improve the court process. And then the Department of Human Services, Health and Human Services Court Improvement Grant. This grant helps to fund our Children's Justice Initiative, which is a collaboration between the Supreme Court and the Department of Human Services to ensure abused and neglected children involved in the child protection system get safe, stable, and permanent families. So, again, we use that grant for some research, providing information in terms of orders and forms, training, et cetera.
Mr. Shorbury, Representative O'Neill has a question.
Just a really quick clarification question. So I know MnCASA put together a working group regarding the sexual assault kits and what to do with them, and it's quite inclusive. Is that money, I know that they got some money to fund that. Is that coming through that your first line item up here of the Department of Justice and Domestic and the Sexual Violence?
Mr. Shorbury?
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Neill, I am not sure if it's coming through there. I would assume that's where they probably got the grant money. They didn't get it from our portion of the grant, so I can't really speak to the source, but I can try to find out for you.
Follow up.
Is that something that funding would fund, sort of like working groups to work through some issues that are specific to our state? Is that something that would be funded through that?
Mr. Shorbury.
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Neill, with our portion of the grant, we've funded some that specifically touch on the court process, but I know that other groups are funded through other parts of the grant because we're only getting 5%, so there's a lot more money coming to the state than the portion we get.
Thank you.
Representative Becker-Finn has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know a couple weeks ago nobody seemed to have any idea about this, but I just wanted to kind of check in to see if we've received any kind of indication if those funds coming from the Department of Justice are going to be something that will continue in future years.
Mr. Shorba?
Mr. Chair, Representative Becker-Finn, I would love to be able to say it will. It's still sort of up in the air. There has not been authorization to continue it right now. There are a couple of bills in the Congress to try to do that, but they have not moved through yet, so we're still sort of up in the air about that.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, Mr. Shorbrook.
Right now I'll move on to talk about our fiscal year 18 and 19 budget request. Our priority in the Minnesota Judicial Branch has been and will be to continue to be able to deliver prompt justice for the people we serve. And so after careful consideration, the Judicial Council has come up with these five components of our budget request for fiscal year 18 and 19. The total is a little over $51 million, or about 7.9% of our current base budget. I'm going to talk briefly about the first request for employee and judge compensation, and then I'll ask Judge Mark to contribute his comments. As I just noted, and I've talked to you before, we are in the midst of implementing many new technology changes in the judicial branch to provide more efficient and better service to the needs of Minnesotans. Our ability to implement this innovation has been based on the talented and experienced judges and staff within the court system. In order to continue to attract and retain those individuals, we believe that we need to request an additional compensation pool of 3.5% each year for our employees. Also, we have in this request the estimates that we are getting from Minnesota Management and Budget of what the employer share of insurance costs will be in 18 and 19. And then there's current discussion about a 1.5% increase to the employer share for pension contributions. We understand that the governor may be looking at different numbers, and we'll continue to monitor to see what comes out of the pension committee. During the height of the recession, we were forced to impose a multi-year salary freeze in order to preserve essential court functions while managing difficult budget conditions. Employees did not receive permanent compensation increases for those 5 years, but at times other parts of both state and local government were providing increases to their employees, which led to us falling behind. We did receive new funding from the legislature in the last two bienniums to help with that, and we're very grateful for those contributions.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hilfer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Was that a self-imposed restriction, or was that a legislative-imposed restriction that you were not able to, the hiring freeze and the compensation freeze?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, the Judicial Council made a decision not to provide additional compensation because we received no new money for compensation. So as you saw from our budget overview, a very high percentage of our budget goes to people. So if we were to have given compensation increases, we would have had to lay off employees, and the council chose to keep our staff, to keep our operations going, rather than lay off and provide money for compensation.
Representative Hillstrom.
So the judicial branch continues to have some issues attracting and retaining our workforce. A challenge includes our salary structure and the retirement wave that we are seeing among our employees. In recent years, we've had experience competing for employees, not only with the private sector, but also with other governmental entities. In the summer of 2015, we did an independent salary study, which showed that our salary structure was consistently below market compared to other state and local public sector employees. So although we have received some compensation in the last two bienniums, we believe in order to stay competitive, we need some additional funding. Just to give you some context, within the next 10 years, 30% of current judicial branch staff will be 65 years or older. So we are seeing that retirement wave occurring. Our second compensation request is for judges, an increase of 3.5% each year of the biennium, and, again, the employer cost of unavoidable health care increases. Judicial branch works very hard to attract and retain the best and brightest jurists for our courts. However, we lose our ability to gain the interest of highly competent lawyers if we're not able to keep salaries competitive. We're seeing, especially in greater Minnesota, that primarily only public sector attorneys apply for the jobs, and that's not to say that public sector attorneys don't make good judges, but we would like to see a balanced rank within our judiciary. This just gives you a few examples in recent judicial vacancies, especially in greater Minnesota, where the number of applicants was very small. Generally, we would get well over 20 applicants for a judgeship, and you see in Fergus Falls, Aiken, and Waseca, the numbers were down. Despite that, rankings nationally in terms of our performance are quite good. Number 7 in the nation by the National Center for Access to Justice in providing access to citizens, and number 13 by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce in its fairness of litigation and our litigation environment. This slide shows you a little bit of our salary ranking for district court judges nationally. Currently, our judges rank 19th in compensation when adjusted for inflation. We're not seeking to be rated number one, but we do believe we should strive to remain in the top 20. Again, the retirement wave that I talked about with employees is also true with judges. By 2020, at least 37% of all judges that were on the bench in 2015 will either have retired or have turned 65 years old. I'm now going to ask Judge Mark to add any comments he might have on the judicial compensation increase.
Morning, Judge. Go ahead with your name and title.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Kevin Mark. I'm a trial court district judge in Red Wing, which is Goodhue County. For those of you who were on the committee 2 years ago, I'm the same guy you saw then. I'm finishing up my term of office as president. of the District Judges Association. The District Judges Association is composed of nearly all of the trial bench. It's not obligatory, it's voluntary, but just about all of our trial court judges are members of the association. But it's also open to and has members of the appellate court as well as the Supreme Court. A little more background on myself. I was appointed in 2002. In Red Wing, as in many of the outstate courts, I handle everything. I do everything from juveniles, conciliation, sexual assault, murder trials, civil matters. You get the full gamut. There's no specialty or otherwise. Every day is a little different. It's something that I like and enjoy in my job. Something that I want to reference about my personal background that I think is pertinent this morning. As I said, I was appointed in 2002. That was my first time of applying. 2 years earlier, in 2000, there was an opening in Red Wing. I was in private practice, reasonably content and successful in that regard. But I had some people that said, hey, Judge, or Kevin, have you ever thought about being a judge? And I really hadn't, but I gave it some thought. I actually gained some materials. I took an application, looked at it, and I looked at the financial structure as well. And I was a father of three young children. All things considered, the financial package was a disincentive for me, and I did not fill out an application. 2 years later, in the spring of 2002, the legislature took action on judicial salaries. As has been done subsequently, as has been done in the past, the District Judges Association used a study of Dr. Carl Egge, who was a fairly renowned economist in the metro area. And Dr. Egge opined that the judges were 20% underpaid. And I'm not saying all credit to him, but the legislature in the 2002 session made a significant move on judicial salaries. So in the summer of that year, an announcement was made that there would be another opening in Red Wing, Goodhue County. And I again took a look at it. And then I saw the change in compensation. And I'm here to tell you that it had a substantial impact on my decision to make application. And I was one of 32 applicants for that position. I was fortunate enough to be appointed. But again, to a private attorney looking at this position, the financial package does make a difference. So what I want to talk about this morning is kind of the history of where we've come. In 2002, after that move, we were in the top 20 of judges' salaries across the country. And as Mr. Shorb has indicated, because of wage freezes of 5 years, we slipped considerably from that rank. And during that time, when there were wage freezes, it didn't impact the work effort of the judges or of their staff, of all the people in the public sector. They work just as hard. And as a matter of fact, I think you find that when the economy goes south, the legal work tends to pick up. That was true in my private practice as well. So you work just as hard. Your work effort isn't dependent upon the income. What I'm here to talk about today is rather continuing to attract talented people outside of just the public sector, private attorneys, to be part of the judiciary in Red Wing, or excuse me, in the state of Minnesota. Now, as I said, we slipped, we dropped out of the top 20, we weren't even in the top 30. And 4 years ago, the Judges Association used a report by Dr. Corrine Moe, another economist. And she made recommendations, and we received from the governor and from this legislature increases in pay that brought us up. But as recent as 2 years ago, we were still outside of the top 30. And as a result of the compensation increases 2 years ago, we now have moved up to 25th in the country, 19th when adjusted for cost of living. And again, we want to maintain that. As Mr. Shorb indicated, a number of judges, as you can see on the slide, approximately a third of our current judges will be looking at retirement in the next 5 years. And we want to have this pool of talent to be broad and deep so that we can continue to benefit from the best people in this position. Now, in this particular session, we have provided for you a report from a Dr. Christine West, who is an economist at St. Catharines. She looked at the national rankings. She also looked at more in the local market. What is it about the local market that makes this position of being a judge attractive to potential candidates? She points out one anomaly that I pointed out a couple of years ago, and that has to do with prosecutors who come before us in the trial court. And I'm not talking about county attorneys now who administer their offices. I'm talking about the people they hire to be litigants, to be prosecutors in our courtroom. In some of the larger counties, in order for them to attract talented people, they pay wages that are in excess of what the judges receive in whom front of they come, and they ask for us to make difficult decisions. So to try to close that gap and to keep us competitive in some sense, she made a recommendation above what the judicial branch is asking. The judicial branch is asking 3.5. She recommends a 4.63 increase in the next 2 years for judges to, again, close this gap and to continue to be competitive for potential candidates. I want to talk to you just for a few more moments about being a judge, the special position it is, and why I'm here today on behalf of the Judges Association asking for a raise in our compensation. Being a judge is a heavy position. It's also a very, very humbling position. It's humbling because of the people that come before you every day. And I'm not talking about just the plaintiffs and the defendants, the petitioners and the respondents. I'm talking about the public sector employees that work in the system whose work product comes before you. You're humbled by the court staff. I'm down in court administration every day signing orders, and I'll see someone at the window, the face of our court system, talking to people that are sometimes angry, sometimes confused, sometimes scared. They talk with them patiently, trying to put them in the right direction. Or I might hear them on the phone the same way, answering questions very professionally, courteously, at times hearing an edge on the other side, but again, maintaining their calm and trying to steer them in the right direction. They tee up our calendars. They provide us the information that we need so that we can do our job. I'm humbled by technology, as I'm sure a few of you are. All the law libraries in the world are at my fingertips, but then all of a sudden it can go blink, and we come to a halt, and our technology people get a call, and just like that, I'm back in touch with the world and we're up and running. And I joke that there's been a few early retirements, I think, amongst judges because of the humbling effect of technology. I'm humbled by my court reporter. I've been a lawyer, a judge now for over 35 years, and yeah, you used to see a few different people in the court system in different accents. Nowadays, the diversity that comes into our court system, yes, we have interpreters, but we have a lot of people that speak English, but they speak English in a way that it's difficult for me to understand. But my court reporter, it's his or her job to make sure that that person's case is afforded the same accuracy as anyone else's. And so they'll stop the proceedings and say, I'm sorry, sir, I didn't hear you, or could you speak up, or could you move closer to the microphone, to make sure that their recorded words are accurately put down. I'm humbled by public defenders, people who work day in and day out with people that aren't necessarily the nicest clientele, and oftentimes not very appreciative. But they carry caseloads of 100, 150 open cases that no private attorney would ever try to do. I'm humbled by probation officers who do the same thing, who, again, don't have the best clientele in the world, but are trying to make a difference in people's lives. And sometimes they have to chase them down and bring them to court, but they'll still work with them, even though they may not deserve another chance. And I'm humbled by law enforcement people that put their uniforms every day and don't take for granted that they may not be the ones taking their uniform off at the end of the day. Someone might be cutting it off with a scissors. I'm humbled by the social workers, the guardians ad litem, who write reports to us in child protection cases and family cases, and sometimes it's difficult to read this stuff. The stories of the infants that sitting there chewing on a piece of tinfoil that just moments ago had methamphetamine in it, or they're sitting next and playing with a used syringe while the passed out parent is there, and they're laying in filth and garbage. And these social workers are on the ground. Their fingernails are dirty. They're picking up this child and bringing him or her to the safe place. And while one day they're rescuers and saviors, a week later they're they're scorned and rebuked and get out of our life, get out of our way. This is a family matter. And they know their job isn't done, and they continue to persist even when they're unwelcomed. I'm humbled by all these people, prosecutors, who work with pro se litigants. Pro se meaning they're representing themselves. Why? Well, they have a job. They don't qualify for a public defender, but with their income, they can't afford to pay $200-$300 an hour to an attorney, so they show up representing themselves. And pro se litigants, ladies and gentlemen, are just a common feature now for judges and prosecutors and everyone to work with, and you try to guide them in the right direction. But I'll see prosecutors who are there to convict people that need to deal with the consequences of their action, but also working with people that maybe need a break or maybe just need some direction on how to get their driver's license back so they can keep their job, so they can pay their child support, so that other things will then all work. And the body of work of all of these public sector employees is only worthwhile to them if they have faith and confidence in the judicial system, so all of their efforts come to a fruitful result. And that depends on people like me. And it's a job with considerable burden and stress, but great rewards. And working with all of these people is part of that. So we need talented people in this position, my position, so that all of these other people's work really is worthwhile and rewarding and fruitful for them and for the people of Minnesota. So I ask you to keep these things in mind when you go about your difficult job of trying to weigh the pluses and the minuses and make the dollars stretch. Chairman Cornish, I appreciate your support and your leadership. I will be available for questions at the appropriate time.
And just before I take a question, to editorialize a little bit, which I get heck for sometimes.
Careful.
Yeah, the judge's compensation is, the reason it's so important. Some people, when you go back to your caucuses or whatever, will ask, well, why don't they just settle for consumer price index or rate of inflation? I think what the point they're trying to get across is we got to worry about more than that. And if we fall behind too much, then we end up like we have in the past, we got to make the whole thing up in a one biennium and give a raise that looks out of the norm. So the judges are trying to worry about quality people, like they say, and it's not uncommon in businesses and our state agencies to do comparative worth studies and Hays studies, that they're called, and compare them to other states and other job classifications. And even though there might be 1% inflation, by giving them 3% or 4% or 5% or whatever they decide on, they're trying to catch up so you don't run into those big gaps. And with the judges, what they're talking about is they're making almost life and death decisions here. And so you want the brightest and the best in those positions. And if the pay isn't there, you're going to get a lesser quality candidate sometimes. You know, and some of them don't care, and they'll put themselves out there. But you can tell by the pool is definitely getting smaller. And as the pool gets smaller, you're naturally going to get the not quality candidate. And Representative Hilsman, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a couple of questions, actually, for Mr. Shorba based on the presentation, if that would be all right, Mr. Chair.
Yes. Mr. Shorba?
Mr. Shorba, can you tell me why the Judicial Council made the presentation or the request for the judge salary increase that's in the budget versus what the report actually showed?
Mr. Shorba.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hilsman. The Judicial Council has to weigh all kinds of different things in looking at a budget request. One of the things that the Council is very strong about is we want to request what we need and fight for that rather than requesting larger amounts and then negotiating away smaller dollar figures. As you can see, as I'll get to the rest of the presentation, there are a lot of things in addition to compensation that was important to the Council to ask for, and so we had to weigh some of these requests, and that's why we landed on a 3.5. The other factor was we wanted to make sure that we were providing similar requests for employees as we were for judges, so that was another factor.
Mr. Chair, that led perfectly into my next question, which was, did you do a comparable worth study for your staff, and are you closer to being where you should be on the comparable worth for your staff, or is that out of sync? And if it is, why then did you only ask for that lower amount for them as well?
Mr. Schroeder.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, we did a compensation study in the summer of 2015. It at that point said that we needed additional compensation. We got compensation in the last two bienniums. What we're really trying to do here is to keep up with the other public sector employers, which generally give at least 3% increases, whether that's other parts of state government or other parts of county government. So this is really an effort for us to keep pace, and we believe that the 3.5% will allow us to do that.
Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
Thank you. So you had said that you did a compensation study previously. So are you doing another one, or do you anticipate you'll be doing another one to find out if you're starting to come into compliance a bit with some comparable worth? Because I don't know that when we gave the significant raise, we actually brought you to where you needed to be in comparable worth, but my memory may be missing.
Mr. Schorba.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, yes, we are going to do a follow-up study. We've been sort of updating the numbers. As you know, every year it changes because somebody's giving something out there that we have to keep track of. So the studies are only as good as you update them, and we are updating that study annually.
So, Mr. Chair, last question then.
Go ahead.
So do you have a copy of last year's study then, and can we see how close to comparable worth you actually are?
Sure. We could provide, Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, we could provide information to the committee specifically on the study.
Thank you.
Yep. Representative Beckerfin, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so I want to start with sharing, I say this as a former law clerk, judicial law clerk, and a current Hennepin County assistant Hennepin County attorney. So I just wanted to share that I know for a lot of folks, I know at least one other person at this table was also a judicial law clerk, that is really important because I'm sure I know many judges will say, you know, they're only as good as their staff. And because of the caseloads and the amount of work that goes into it. And so I just wanted to speak to that. It is really important that we keep a focus on that as well, because I know a lot of folks would probably clerk for longer but can't really afford to because of the salaries that are out there in other places. And then I just wanted to comment on something that, Judge, that you stated, and if you'll indulge me for the record, most assistant Hennepin County attorneys do not make as much as the numbers that are on this sheet, just so we're all square with our other public sector attorneys. Thank you for your statements and this information.
All right. Any more questions? You go ahead and proceed with the rest of your slides.
I'll move on to the second component of the budget request, which is our mandated services deficit request. As I previously noted, state and federal laws mandate that certain services be provided to people who interact with the court system. The judicial branch has experienced significant increases in the cost of providing some of these services, specifically in the areas of interpreter services and psychological examinations. Minnesota Statute 611.30 provides that someone must be provided with an interpreter in court proceedings to assist them in understanding the court proceedings. Courts are mandated to provide and pay for this service to those who do not speak English and those who are deaf or hard of hearing. The role of the court interpreter is to assist these individuals in understanding court proceedings and to speak on behalf of the individual during the proceedings. This slide gives you an idea of some of the languages that we see in the court system. Interpreter services are provided during the court session, plus interpreting for the parties, attorneys, and witnesses immediately prior to court proceedings or immediately following court proceedings. In fiscal year 16, 81 different language interpreters were requested in our courts for over 26,000 court events. The slide shows the top 10 languages requested and the number of court events for the languages shown on this slide. In order to provide these services, the judicial branch uses a combination of employee interpreters and contract interpreters. At present, we have 6.5 interpreters on staff throughout the court system, and for the remaining need, all districts use contract interpreters chosen from a roster maintained by the State Court Administrator's Office. At present, there are 297 interpreters on the roster. All interpreters on the roster must attend an orientation session and must achieve a passing score on an ethics and legal terminology examination. Spoken language interpreters must also achieve a passing score on a written English proficiency test. Contract interpreters are paid an hourly rate, depending on the qualifications for the interpreter, and they're paid for a two-hour minimum fee and mileage. So as you can see from this slide, there are two levels of sign language interpreters, those who have legal specialist certification, and those who have general certifications who are on our national roster, statewide roster. Spoken language interpreters, there are three levels. Minnesota administers a certification program for spoken language interpreters. To be certified in a particular language, you must pass a very rigorous examination. So those who qualify as certified. We also maintain a roster of those who have not been able to pass that test but have still gone through our orientation and ethics training. And then if we cannot find someone who is either certified or on our national or statewide roster, there is a group of non-rostered individuals, and they get paid based on their qualifications. We are seeing some challenges in the interpreter area. First of all, a shrinking pool of people who are trained to do this work. Other organizations also are now hiring more people to be staff interpreters, so the pool of contractors is shrinking. We are also seeing a lot of competition with other heavy users, which could be other parts of government, as well as hospitals use these interpreters very frequently. So again, we looked at some salary data from 22 state and local interpreter users and vendors, and are requesting increases for both spoken language and for sign language based on the survey that we did. So it would bring certified interpreters up by $3 an hour and non-certified $2 an hour for sign language, and a 4% increase in spoken language interpreters. We believe that would help us to be more competitive in this particular area.
Mr. Schor, Representative Neuberger has a question, and then Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Schor, just a quick clarification. The interpreters, are these folks where they're in person or are using technology like the hospitals use, so where they bring in a computer screen and they have an interpreter online and they do it interactively?
Sure.
Mr. Chair, Representative Neuberger, both. We do use them in person, especially if it's going to be a lengthy proceeding, certainly if it's going to be a trial. But if it is a very short proceeding, they could be either on the phone or using the technology that you referenced. Especially in outstate Minnesota, we've used more of that technology.
Representative Neuberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So in your opinion, which one would be more cost-effective?
Mr. Schorba.
Mr. Chair, Representative Neuberger, I think that's pretty clear. If you don't have to pay mileage, it's certainly more cost-effective. But we also want to make sure we're getting comprehension, so both of those things are balanced out.
Thank you.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And actually, before I go on to what I was going to bring up, to Representative Neuberger's question, he asked about cost-effective, and definitely it is cheaper, so the cost part is good, but I guess I might disagree or want to hear the comment on sometimes it may not be cost-effective. It may not be the most effective thing to do it at a distance, as you referenced comprehension and understanding. Am I right in kind of making that distinction that although it may be the cheapest thing, it may not be the most cost-effective when you take effectiveness into account?
Mr. Schorfer.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pinto, I would agree with that, and I don't know if Judge Mark wants to comment because he does this on a daily basis, but interpreter sessions are very difficult for all parties. It takes a lot more time. Obviously, there are language issues that need to be dealt with and comprehension issues, so both of those have to be taken into consideration.
And then, Mr. Chair. I guess I did want to highlight the request for interpreter services, and particularly noticing in our binder, I'm totally supportive of the request for increase in judicial salaries and the other pieces we've talked about, but at least there has been an increase in funding since 2002. If I'm reading this correctly, the last time that the payment rate for sign language interpreters was increased was 2006, and for the other interpreters, it hasn't increased since 1999. I guess I just wanted to highlight that and understand, am I reading that right, that actually these figures have been set for now, getting close to 20 years in the case of most of the interpreters?
On Mr. Shorba.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pinto, you are correct. It's been a long time since these rates have been increased.
Yeah. And then, Mr. Chair, I'll just comment for the, it seems like a pretty, I'm surprised it's such a tiny amount of money considering what a critical role interpreters play. And I can think of many trials I've had where, I mean, boy, the interpreters were absolutely critical to the, critical to that trial and working incredibly hard. So, thank you.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I want to make it very clear, have you make it very clear, the cost of interpreters is only for example, a defendant or a party to the case. It does not cover an interpreter for a victim if the victim needs one in, for example, a criminal matter. So that's a gap currently. Is that correct?
Mr.
Chair, Representative Hillstrom, you are correct.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's my understanding that in addition to the pay not being increased, that in fact that we are having difficulty in competing, because it's my understanding that a large number of folks only use the state court approved list for other interpretive services. So if we give the increase that you're proposing, do you believe that that makes this group, your pay, competitive enough to still have the ample resources to have the interpreters you need, or do you believe that the market will just increase that pay too?
Mr. Shorba.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, based on our study and how we came up with these numbers, we believe that this would make us competitive, but again, things change. So if the hospitals start paying more or somebody else starts paying more, we may be back again. But based on our current analysis of the market, we believe this would make us competitive. So.
Okay, proceed, sir.
The other mandated services that I want to talk about is psychological services. Minnesota statutes provide that the courts will pay the court-related cost of examinations in civil commitment cases, including commitments of persons who are mentally ill and dangerous, persons with sexual psychopathic personalities, and sexually dangerous persons. There are two types of psychological examinations required under Rule 20, which I'll talk about on the next slide. The judicial branch, like most other justice agencies, have seen an increase in the number of people entering the system with mental health issues. As a result, the courts have seen substantially increasing costs for psychological examination services due to primarily to an increase in the number of psychological examinations requested in criminal proceedings. So as you can see from the chart, for the period fiscal year 12 through fiscal year 16, the number of cases with court-appointed evaluations increased by 22%, and expenditures for these services have increased 33%. The slide explains the two type of Rule 20 examinations. Rule 20.01 is where a prosecutor, defense attorney, or the court requests an examination to determine if a defendant is competent to stand trial. And then under Rule 20.202, the court may order an examination if defense notifies the prosecution the defendant will plead not guilty by reason of mental illness or deficiency. In the case of misdemeanors, if the defendant pleads not guilty by reason of mental illness or deficiency, and if the defendant offers evidence of mental illness or deficiency. In both cases, many examinations are required for Rule 20.01 and 20.02. In 86 counties, the state contracts with licensed psychologists, licensed psychiatrists, and licensed medical doctors to perform these services. Hennepin County relies primarily on licensed staff that they employ to do these examinations due to their volume. It's becoming increasingly difficult to find individuals, especially in greater Minnesota, to perform these examinations. The cost varies, mostly because of travel and other things, and you can see the average costs in non-metro and metro counties for each of these examinations. Our budget requests a little over $2 million to fill this hole and deal with this increase that we are seeing in these kinds of examinations.
Mr. Shorba, we should back up once to the Rule 20 exams. Maybe this would be a bad question to ask a judge, but what we've heard sometimes is that defense attorneys will pull a Rule 20 to intimidate the prosecutor out of going because it's so expensive for the county. Does the judge have to grant a Rule 20? What are the maybe the judge would be the one that best to ask if it's asked for, or do you have some discretion on that?
Mr. Chairman, that does, the situation you described about using it as leverage, I have not seen, but that's my local county. I can't speak to other counties and what the culture might be between public defenders and the prosecutors and what games might be played. Generally speaking, if either the prosecutor or the public defender advises the court they think a Rule 20 is appropriate, I don't ask any questions because there's too much of a risk. All the proceedings going forward could be tainted if there's any possibility that the defendant at that time doesn't understand what's going on, isn't competent to proceed. You play it cautiously.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Our next request is to create two trial court judge units. A judge unit consists of a judge, a law clerk, and a court reporter. We have not requested from the legislature additional trial court judgeships since 2007. If funded, these judgeships would be placed in the 7th Judicial District, which is in the middle of the state from St. Cloud to Moorhead, and the 9th Judicial District, which are the 17 counties in the far northwest corner of the state. As I mentioned in my...
Mr. Chair.
Representative Phil.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry, I want to go back to the other slide for a moment to the Rule 20. Do we know how much money is spent every year by the local jurisdictions on Rule 20s, or is that something that we could get if the chair is concerned that people are in local jurisdictions are making those motions frivolously or for a reason if they were state-funded and not based on the county's ability to pay, there may be a disincentive to do that.
For sure.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, I believe we could get that information. I'm looking over at my staff to see, but I'm told we can get that information.
That would be great. Thank you.
Where that claim came up was in a county where we increased the charge for the mentally ill and dangerous in St. Peter. We made it a fourth, like we increased it to a fourth degree assault because the county attorneys or some were saying the charge was so low it didn't pay him to all the expense to bring him in. Plus, Rule 20s were ordered in every one as a matter of course, and so it got to be so expensive for a case so minimal, so that's why I ended up increasing the charge to a higher degree. But that's the background on that. So go ahead, Mr. Schroeder, with your presentation.
As I discussed in my overview a few weeks ago, since fiscal year 12, the judicial branch has seen an increase in the number of major case filings and an increase in the complexity of the cases brought to the trial courts. As a result, 8 of our 10 judicial districts have seen an upward trend in judge need. The most marked increase is in children in need of protection or services cases and permanency cases with a 56% increase. Over the last year, major criminal case filings rose 12% and drug-related case filings increased 25% over the last year. So these are the cases that take a lot of judge time, which is why we're seeing our need for additional judges going up. As I just noted, most of our judicial districts have seen an increase in the need for additional judge resources. If you look at the statistics today, you will see that caseloads are growing in most of the districts. However, given that caseloads can fluctuate, the judicial branch does not rely on just 1 year of data to determine need. We use a 3-year rolling average of need when determining the number of judges needed. This judge need is based on a weighted caseload analysis used to determine the number of judges needed to provide effective case resolution. We've been using this type of analysis since 1980. It's a proven and highly effective strategy, but the results must be periodically examined and updated as laws and court processes change. So it uses 3 types of information. One is case weights, which is a complex way of saying how long does it take a judge to process a certain type of case. So minor criminal cases are going to take longer than a first-degree murder case. So we assign case weights to each of the types of cases. Then we look at how much time a judge has during the year to do judicial work, given vacation and sick leave and other kinds of things. And then we look at the case filings. And are they going up? And which types of cases are going up? And then we use a mathematical formula to determine where the judge need is. And currently we're seeing, based on that 3-year rolling average, a need for 2 judges, as I mentioned. So that is our request.
Mr. Shorter?
Yes?
Do you ever get any complaints from the judges about the weighted caseload analysis as to certain districts? They say they need a judge, but it doesn't show in the studies you do that they do. Is there ever any differing opinions about that?
Mr. Chair, there's opinions about everything. But I think that our weighted caseload analysis is pretty well trusted. The judges are really work very hard to come up with it. So as they're analyzing how long does it take to do cases, we use judges on our committees to try to test that. We're currently starting a new analysis of the weighted caseload to look at cases because cases change as well. So maybe we have more interpreters. So those cases take longer, and we need to assign case weights differently for those kinds of cases. Or maybe we're seeing some of these children in need of protection cases taking longer because they become more complex or drugs are involved. So it's a constant reanalysis. The council, I think, felt very strongly that these were the two districts that needed the cases or the judges the most. But
and also thanks to whoever decided to put another judge down in Mankato. That was great. Representative Hills? Did you have a comment?
I was just going to say, Mr. Chairman, that in the association and just discussions with my colleagues, I've never heard any real serious problem with the methodology. I think what we hear, and it's shown by the need in the 7th and 9th, these are outstate rural areas where the logistics, they have longer calendars someday because I think they try to pack things in because people travel. It's much easier in the urban areas to have somebody come back, you know, another day compared to when they're driving 100-plus miles to get to the courthouse.
Representative Hilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I've also heard that there's been some things that don't count. So, for example, if you could let us know how you count some of these specialty courts that take extra time because there's more visits. This legislative body has been consistently supportive of things like veterans courts and drug courts. And I'm curious as to if you modify the weight of the case based on the intensity, or if you exempt those from the weighted caseload, or how you deal with those specialty kinds of settings. I don't expect you to answer today, but if you could let us know.
Okay. Sure.
The growth in both the number and type of treatment courts, as Representative Hillstrom just talked about, has been significant. It's a testament to the popularity of the courts and the fact that they work. In the past 2 years, the branch, with assistance from the National Center for State Courts, has been studying the funding of our treatment courts and steps that can be taken to improve their long-term financial stability. As many of you know, many of these courts have grown up through one-time grants and other kinds of local, sometimes local funding, sometimes funding from the legislature. And so we needed a more equitable and predictable way to fund the courts. So what this request does is try to provide sustainability funding for these treatment courts, not to increase the number of treatment courts. And I'll get into that a little bit more here in a minute. As seen on the map, treatment courts are in place or being...
Excuse me. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just looking through our booklet and trying to find what the base funding was for treatment courts and what the increase is. So I'm sorry, I couldn't find it. So I'm wondering if you could just explain what your base is and what the increase is and how much more you're asking for. And then I do have a question, too, about this slide. I'm going to throw this in also. I was studying this before you got to this and noticed that, you know, I'm in Wright County, which we now have a treatment court. But overall, the 10th Judicial District is... only has two counties that are offering treatment courts. I'm wondering if there's, if you know why that might be. They seem to be out of step with the rest of the state.
Sure.
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Neill. The first question, about $5 million, a little over $5 million is state appropriation. And then there's almost $10 million in grants for a total base budget of about $15 million. Again, only five of that being appropriated money. So this would be an additional $3.3 million for sustainability of those courts. So it would certainly add to the number. And then as far as the 10th district goes, each district, you know, sort of is choosing how to roll out some of their courts. We just did get a new federal grant for two courts in Anoka. So they will be operating there. One is a veterans court, one is a drug court. So I think they're gradually starting to increase. But again, some of the districts have been very cautious because if you get a grant and then you cannot sustain that grant, then you're going to close. And so I think certain districts have been challenged with that problem of starting these courts without ongoing funding. So that's one of the reasons why we're asking for this request.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Guilford.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And in response, aren't there some specialty courts that are out there that are not judicial branch approved yet and therefore they don't show up on this? Because I think Stearns County for a long time was had a domestic abuse specialty court that the judicial branch didn't recognize as a specialty court, and so there may be some things out there that are not yet judicial branch approved. Is that accurate?
Mr. Shorba?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, that is accurate. We're trying to have those numbers go down, which I think they have gone down. What you're alluding to is in order to be approved and get funding from the Judicial Council, you have to go through an approval process, which means that you are doing the best practices that are required by the council in policy, and we take those from national studies that show you what are the best ways to operate them. Some jurisdictions can start them on their own. Maybe they've started with county money and have not gone through the formal approval process, but more of our courts now are going through the formal process because they believe in those best practices. So the number of those that are outliers are decreasing.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But they would not show up on this map as existing if they have not yet been approved, even if they're operating. Is that correct?
That's correct. Mr. Chair, Representative Hilson, that's correct. So about 58 operational courts, 11 of those are multi-county court treatment courts. This gives you a little bit idea of the funding in FY16. Showing local government, judicial branch, other kinds of funding, many of them, of course, being grants from various entities to help fund these particular courts. We also received some questions at our last hearing about do they work, and so we wanted to provide some information on studies that have been done. In 2012, the branch released a statewide evaluation that compared drug court participants to similar offenders and found that the drug court participants were less likely to reoffend, spent less time incarcerated, showed gains in employment, et cetera. Also, the Department of Public Safety, which funds many of our DWI courts, did a study on DWI courts in 2014, which had very similar results. And then we included some results from national studies. The multi-state adult drug court evaluation of 23 adult drug courts provided similar results in terms of reduced recidivism, reduced crime, better family relationships, et cetera. And then cost effectiveness. Several analyses, including that multi-state adult drug court evaluation, concluded that drug courts produced an average return on investment of approximately $2 to $4 for every $1 invested, which translates into significant savings for local communities from about $3,000 to $22,000 per participant.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can you, I'm particularly interested in that issue of the cost effectiveness and dollars coming back, and could you just direct me, maybe send to me another time, the studies, and I guess what I'm particularly interested in is when those dollars come back and by what budget and timing, if you understand what I'm asking. I'm just real interested in kind of diving into that.
Mr. Shorba.
Madam Chair, Mr. Representative Pinto, we certainly can. I'll just speak about the DWI court study, which was here in Minnesota. It showed savings of about $1,700 to $11,000 per participant, and that was distributed among various entities, so it could have meant savings to the sheriff's office because there are fewer arrests, savings to the jail because there are fewer jail days, prison days, savings because there was less court time, so you didn't have to have as much court going on. So various entities resulted in savings, but I can give you more specific information on that.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And do you have a sense, so just as long as you're talking off the cuff about those things, as to the timing? Are we talking in sort of the ensuing, you know, year or two? Often when we think about investments that pay off, I'm particularly interested in early childhood, and, you know, you might have to wait 10, 15 years, huge savings. I'm guessing that these savings come pretty quickly, but if you can just talk about that time horizon as well.
Mr. Shorba.
Madam Chair, Representative Pinto. The DWI study was savings over 2 years. So that was a two-year time period.
Great. Thank you.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You can tell there's a lot of interest about treatment courts here. I think a lot of us are incredibly invested in the treatment courts and find it to be, you know, has great ROIs and you know, you've listed some of those, but something that I just thought I would point to is the fact that they're still in their communities. They don't have to walk away from their job or possibly lose their job. They can have communications again with their children. You know, it's very broad reaching. You know, it's less disruptive to their lives. And so I think that's something that needs to be pointed out as well, as not only just the ROI and all the things you listed there, but the reason why that it works is because they're still in their community, they're still connected to their children, their family, their churches, their, you know, social organizations, and they haven't lost their jobs, so that just causes more problems too. And so I know that kind of collectively we're pretty supportive of the treatment courts, and yeah, I'm seeing a lot of head shaking, so that's good. Just to say that publicly and, you know, acknowledge that it's sort of a different way to approach what the courts are doing, and we applaud that approach.
Mr. Sherba, I just want to ask, how did you come up with deciding to call them treatment courts versus specialty courts? Because by calling them treatment courts, it used to be just drug court, which everybody thought just meant drugs, and now it's treatment court, and so everybody thinks it's all about treatment. But there are many, many specialty kinds of courts that can occur or exist, especially when you do things different in the area of child support, or you might do things different in the area of child protection kinds of cases. How did you decide on treatment court versus specialty court? Mr. Sherba.
Madam Chair, that was not my decision. That was a decision of the Judicial Council, and there was a lot of debate. As you know, the lots of names for these courts: specialty, problem-solving, treatment. Again, everyone had an opinion. The majority felt that treatment was the best name for these because it covers things like mental health and veterans, and there's such a big treatment component of all of these courts. Some felt like specialty was not illustrative enough, that was to talk about what these courts are really doing. So there was a lot of debate over a couple different meetings of the council, and the council came up with this name.
Mr. Sherba, is it a formal process by which you're going to ask the legislature to adopt the name of treatment courts, or is there a bill here, or is it just something that you're doing? Because we all might have a different opinion as well, Mr. Sherba.
Madam Chair, I'm sure there's lots of opinions in this room. We do have a policy bill that we are waiting to get back from the revisor's office, which will have some cleanup, and one of the cleanups in the policy bill will be to hopefully get the legislature's agreement that we should change this name to treatment courts and statutes. So there'll be time for that debate, hopefully.
Thank you. Mr. Sherba, go ahead.
So our FY18-19 request seeks to provide more stable funding for these existing treatment courts. Many of the counties without treatment courts today do not have the number of potential participants necessary to justify the cost. So we are committed to having a more equitable funding formula, and these requested funds will be distributed through the new funding formula, and they're aimed at shoring up treatment courts that are dependent and or may be losing shortly grant funding. So it will provide new treatment courts could still be funded through state or federal grants, but once those grant funds have left, there would have to be some other stable funding. Currently, the requirement would be for justice partners to contribute 30% match. We don't think that'll be a problem. We think in most situations, not all, whether it's prosecutor time or probation time, most are already providing at least 30% cash or in-kind support. There will be minimum numbers of participants, so if you want to get funding under this formula, you'd have to have a minimum number of participants. What we're trying to do is encourage more of those multi-county courts. As I mentioned, we have 11 now throughout the state, but for very small jurisdictions, they'd have to join with others and maybe use some of the technology that Representative Neuberger was talking about to hold these drug courts through ITV or other means. So that's what the treatment court request is in order to implement this funding formula. Final component of our request has to do with cybersecurity. This request seeks to provide funds to develop and maintain an information security effort that will mitigate the branch's risk of major data breaches, data corruption, system outages, and cyber attacks. As you know, the branch has recently transitioned to an all-electronic filing of court documents, court records, and online sharing of court records. This has resulted in increased dependence on the branch's technology infrastructure, and we want to ensure that that infrastructure is strong. So this request seeks to develop and implement a cybersecurity program that will protect our infrastructure from theft of private data for those who interact with the court system. As you may know, as was published in the newspapers, the judicial branch has experienced 3 distributed denial of service attacks on our website. It has caused our website to be brought down on those occasions. One of the attacks resulted in our website being brought down for 10 days. Our website is very important to those who interact with our court system, and we are doing all we can to try to build up that infrastructure, but we believe we need additional funding to do that. We are presently working with the FBI to figure out why our website was being attacked in those particular situations. So this request includes funding for staff to help both on the technical engineering side as well as doing more training both for our internal users as well as for our technicians, software that will help to upgrade our systems as well as some outside resources. We recently did a security assessment and found some vulnerabilities. Some of those will need some outside resources to shore up. So that's where this request comes from for cybersecurity.
Representative Neuberger.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a really quick question. Were you able to determine where these attacks originated from?
Mr. Sherba.
Madam Chair, Representative Neuberger. Distributed denial of service attacks take place, and I've learned a lot about them in the last year, take place where somebody has actually used someone else's computer, cell phone, all kinds of other things to attack a particular target. So it's very difficult to tell where they're coming from. Most of these were coming from overseas, from a variety of countries. It's very hard to tell which machine they're coming from. It's very difficult. That's why we're working not only with the FBI, but also with international police to try to figure out more detail. But the structure and the problem is the same for everyone who's getting these attacks. Very difficult to pinpoint a source.
Representative Howe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Sherba, does Minute provide that service, or is this a request through Minute, or is this outside of, does the court system work outside of the Minute framework?
Mr. Sherba.
Madam Chair, Representative Howe, the judicial branch has its own technology infrastructure. We are tied in a lot of ways with Minute in terms of some of the ways our information gets through them. We contract with them to make sure that we have as many lines of information available as we go out to our 87 counties and 106 locations. But this request would be for our own judicial branch infrastructure, similar to the legislature, which has its own technology infrastructure. So, Madam Chair, that is our FY18-19 request in summary. Appreciate the time of the committee and the questions, and certainly willing to answer any more information or questions people may have.
Questions from members? Anything else? I see that Judge Jasper from Anoka is here. Is he going to be testifying today, or is he just here to answer questions?
He's my backup.
All right, seeing no further questions, this meeting is adjourned.
Thank you.